This decision is a legal travesty. Our country now today stands unprotected. Our children are unprotected.
What the gays are saying is we're going to drive you out of town. Either you conform to us or you must leave.
You as a Christian altogether, I think 33 years in all, amazing changes occurred. If Chris and I had been told how things would change in just those 30, 40 years, we would have been amazed.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Uganda's constitutional court kills the anti-homosexuality law on a technicality. U.S. televangelist Pat Robertson leads a questionable Bible study. And Don Bacardi discusses his longtime love with fellow animal Christopher Isherwood. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wendell Jones.
And I'm Michelle Marie Gilkison.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending August 2nd, 2014. Uganda's constitutional court has overturned the country's infamous anti-homosexuality law. LGBT activists, attorneys, and allies cheered inside the packed courtroom when the verdict was announced on August 1st in Uganda's capital city, Kampala. The decision came as a surprise to many. Ahead of the previously announced schedule, the court heard and ruled on the case in the span of just a few days this week. A disappointed pastor, Martin Sempa, one of the country's most vocal supporters of the law, spoke with reporters outside the courtroom.
This case has proceeded in a strange manner. We are aware that the registrar of this court had scheduled that this case would be discussed and started in September. We wonder what happened all of a sudden that a case that was supposed to be for September was taken on with lightning speed.
In their lawsuit challenging the anti-homosexuality law, 10 human rights activists charged that there was no legal quorum in Parliament when the measure was approved. House Speaker Rebecca Kadaga, who had publicly promised prompt passage of the measure more than once, ignored a quorum call and engineered the vote on December 20, 2013. President Yoweri Museveni signed the bill into law in late February of this year. Some Western nations, led by the United States, have imposed economic sanctions on Uganda since the anti-homosexuality law was enacted. Sempa was not alone in speculating about the seemingly rushed ruling, noting President Museveni's pending visit to the U.S. for an African summit.
Is there a possibility that the president traveling to Washington next week could have been the reason why this particular case was hurried at lightning speed? We just wonder if indeed our country is independent, and we want to ask the parliament to investigate the independence of the judiciary.
Among other provisions, the anti-homosexuality law punishes private, consensual, adult, same-gender sex with up to life in prison, makes advocacy for LGBT equality a crime, and requires citizens to report suspected homosexuals to the authorities. Rights activists have reported an explosion in the already homophobic country of mob violence, attempted lynchings, extortion, lost jobs, arrests, evictions, arsons, and suicides in the 5 months since the bill became law.
While equality advocates in Uganda and around the world celebrated the constitutional court ruling, many cautioned that it had not struck a blow for LGBT rights, but had only overturned the law on a legal technicality. The government could appeal the ruling to the nation's Supreme Court, or lawmakers could simply pass the law again with the required number of MPs present to vote. High-profile activist Frank Mugisha, one of the plaintiffs in the case and executive director of Sexual Minorities Uganda, told the Associated Press that he was pleased with the ruling, though nervous about possible backlash because the law enjoys widespread public support.
This is the beginning. It's the beginning of a whole very long battle, and we're still going on to fight this battle because we think there's still many challenges. The law has been struck on technicalities, so the big picture is still there.
MP David Bahati, the author of the Anti-Homosexuality Act, has close ties to cure-peddling U.S. right-wing Christians. As their cause suffered repeated losses in the U.S., several groups and individuals have fomented fear of sexual minorities in the past several years with repeated evangelical visits to Uganda to warn of creeping homosexuality in the East African nation and especially the threat to vulnerable Ugandan children. A defiant Bahati told reporters that, "Gymnastics and simple technicalities will never rule this country. The morals of the people of Uganda will prevail." For his part, anti-LGBT pastor Martin Sempa also vowed to continue the crusade.
Our country now today stands unprotected. Our children are unprotected. So we are going to fight. We want to enjoin with the Attorney General to appeal this to the Supreme Court. This decision is a legal travesty. It is an insult to all family, culture-loving people in Luganda.
Proponents of reparative therapy claim to be able to cure LGBT people, and one so-called clinic is going on trial in China. The country declassified homosexuality as a mental disorder in 2001. And a gay Chinese man announced this week that he's suing a psychological clinic for carrying out electric shock treatments intended to turn him heterosexual, and giant search engine Baidu for advertising the clinic. 30-year-old Yang Teng told the Associated Press that he voluntarily underwent the treatments in February following pressure from his parents to get married and have children, but that he can now finally accept his homosexual orientation. Yang is suing for the costs of the alleged therapy and his travel to the clinic, as well as lost earnings because of the time he took off from work. He is also demanding an apology on the websites of both companies. Yang's attorney said that a judgment could be issued within 6 months. The Beijing LGBT Center said it's the first court case in the country challenging so-called conversion therapy.
In other news, LGBT Pride was celebrated peacefully this week in Russia, India, and the Faroe Islands. Given the option by St. Petersburg officials of holding a Pride rally in a trash dump or an overgrown landfill, activists in Russia's second-largest city rallied instead on July 26th at the Field of Mars in downtown St. Petersburg, where unauthorized political actions are often allowed. About 25 people showed up for the rally. Violence ended efforts to hold a similar event in the same location last year. One participant told the Moscow Times that the lack of violence this year was probably because nationalists and religious conservatives, the groups most vocally opposed to LGBT rights, are preoccupied with the current crisis in Ukraine. The rally was organized by the LGBT rights group Ravnopravya, which is Russian for equality.
An annual Pride March was held for the fifth time in the Indian state of Kerala on the same weekend, and for the first time in the city of Kochi. A public meeting about harassment and persecution of LGBT people by police officials and other bullies was held after the march.
Police in the Faroe Islands estimated that 1 in 10 people in the country marched with LGBT Pride on July 27th. The Faroe Islands are an autonomous nation and a dependency of Denmark. Approximately 50,000 people live there, and police said about 5,000 of them were at the march in the capital city of Tórshavn. The Faroe Islands is the only Nordic country other than Finland to deny civil marriage to same-gender couples. Recent polls have shown support for marriage equality among Faroe Islanders, running as high as 68%. But lawmakers defeated a proposal in March to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples there by a vote of 20-11.
In this week's U.S. marriage news, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals has become the latest federal appeals court to strike down a ban on civil marriage for gay and lesbian couples, this time involving the Commonwealth of Virginia. A district judge overturned the ban in February. The Attorney General then filed the appeal at the Fourth Circuit, which heard arguments in mid-May and issued the ruling on July 28th. The Virginia Attorney General's office, under then-Republican Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli, defended the ban until Democrat Mark Herring took office. Herring reversed course and agreed with the plaintiffs that the ban is unconstitutional. That left two county clerks to defend the ban before the Fourth Circuit. State officials are expected to challenge the ruling at the U.S. Supreme Court. Similar to the appeals of Tenth Circuit rulings, overturning Utah's and Oklahoma's ban, the High Court is not obligated to hear any of them. The Richmond-based Fourth Circuit has jurisdiction not only over Virginia, but also over Maryland, which has already opened civil marriage to same-gender couples, as well as West Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina. And like the states impacted by the Tenth Circuit rulings, this week's Fourth Circuit decision was stayed pending a Supreme Court appeal, preventing same-gender couples from immediately marrying in those states.
Within hours of the Fourth Circuit's decision, North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper, a Democrat, told reporters that courts have consistently rejected arguments by Virginia and other states citing the supremacy of procreation or the sanctity of traditional marriage.
Since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Windsor, all federal courts have rejected these arguments each and every time. So it's time for the state of North Carolina to stop making them.
But South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson says he'll continue to defend his state's 2006 voter-approved constitutional ban on civil marriage for gay and lesbian couples. And a spokesman for Republican Governor Nikki Haley said that this administration will continue to uphold the will of the people.
And finally, when do you know that your boss is homophonic? Ask a writer for the Utah-based Noman Global Language Center. The company's social media blogger, Tim Torgeldsen, told the Salt Lake Tribune that he thought that an article he posted about homophones, words that sound the same but have different meanings and often different spellings, for example, bear, B-E-A-R, and bear, B-A-R-E, would be something useful for those in the early stages of learning English. But the company's owner, Clark Woodger, warned Torgeldsen that the article suggested that the school was promoting homosexuality. And when the writer posted his Facebook exchanges about it with Woodger, he was fired. Noman is Utah's largest private English as a second language school and caters primarily to foreign students seeking admission to U.S. colleges and universities. Woodger says that most only have a rudimentary grasp of English and worried that some students may see the homo and think it has something to do with gay sex.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 2nd, 2014. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and produced by Steve Pride.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michelle Marie Gilkison.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
All about Edmund White's latest memoir and Christopher Isherwood's love life later in the program. The case of a Colorado cake shop was settled in early June with the State Civil Rights Commission ordering the proprietor to stop discriminating against same-gender couples. Televangelist Pat Robertson's predictably perverse analysis on his conservative Christian 700 Club this week was noted by Right Wing Watch.
If God in his word says that it's an abomination for a man to lie with a man as with a woman, that's what it says, it's an abomination. And also the Bible says that for these things the land shall vomit you out. And so there's a clear warning that those who participate, the name of this stuff is sodomy. And it has to do with a city named Sodom that was given over to all kinds of perverse sex practices. They even wanted to have sex with angels. And God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. That's what the term comes from, the destruction. And so what our civil rights commissions and others are saying is we want to endanger our society and set it up for the judgment of God. And if you Christians don't like it, then get out. Because well, I don't know. Lot apparently didn't like what was happening in Sodom and Gomorrah, and some angels took him out. We don't really want to leave because we like it. And that gentleman out in Colorado likes his business. He's been in business for a long time. And what the gays are saying is, we're going to drive you out of town. Either you conform to us or you must leave. That's the message that's being put out. It's the same message that there was in Sodom and Gomorrah. You're either going to have sex with angels or have open sex with anybody, or else you leave or you go out of business. That's America. You don't want that, do you?
Ironically, televangelist Pat Robertson's hate speech may be a better example of sodomy than loving LGBT people are. According to the book of Ezekiel, now this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and needy. They were haughty and did hateful things before me.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
The letters and times of the animals, after the observations of the keeper at a different zoo.
Americans were and are the least seductive of people. After all, America and Britain are the countries where a politician can be pushed out of office or impeached if it's discovered he has a mistress, or even an overeager intern with no sense of discretion. In France, seduction is a form of politeness.
That was Edmund White with a tasty tidbit from his latest memoir, Inside a Pearl, My Years in Paris. Our queer life and literature commentator Janet Mason was a bit surprised to discover how easily she was able to relate to White's words.
I knew about Edmund White long before I read his books. I knew that he was a gay icon and had written many books, fiction and nonfiction. I knew that he was especially known for his coming-of-age novel, A Boy's Own Story, written in 1982, around the time that it came out. I knew that he had lived in Paris for a time and had written a biography of Jean Genet, the controversial French poet, playwright, and novelist who was born in 1910. When I heard about White's latest book, Inside a Pearl, My Years in Paris, I decided that it was time to read Edmund White. As a lesbian writer, even as one who has known many interesting people, I have very little in common with White. When I started reading Inside a Pearl, which is replete with name-dropping, complete with a description of one of Elton John's parties, this became clear to me. But I kept reading. And what I found was Edmund White I could relate to, one who could lay his life on the page. I heard it said that a writer's best asset is willingness to be vulnerable. It was when I read about White's experiences as a caretaker of friends and lovers with HIV, and being HIV positive himself, along with the ups and downs of his friendships with both men and women, that I began to relate to him. His vulnerabilities made him human. He ruminates about his decision to live in Paris. I asked myself why I was here. Sure, I'd won a Guggenheim and a small but regular contract with Vogue to write once a month on cultural life. In New York, when I was president of Gay Men's Health Crisis, the biggest and oldest AIDS organization in the world, I hadn't liked myself in the role of leader. I was power mad and tyrannical, and secretly I wanted the party to go on and thought that moving to Europe would give me a new lease on promiscuity. Paris was meant to be an AIDS holiday. After all, I was of the Stonewall generation, equating sexual freedom with freedom itself. But by 1984, many gay guys I knew were dying in Paris as well. There was no escaping from the disease. White goes on to write about his life in Paris and the friendships that he forged, many through his writing projects. He also writes about the French tradition of older gay men calling their younger lovers their nephew. He writes about an interaction between two gay men when one says to the other, "Do you know my nephew?" And the other replies, "Yes, he was my nephew last year." Pat, who was notorious in London literary circles for her affair with Jeanette Winterson, looked around and said, "What's annoying about Paris is that every woman looks like a lesbian but none is." White goes on to write, "Pat was one of my favorite people." In his sardonic style, White introduces us to the cast of characters that he has met and interacted with on the road of life. Not surprisingly, many, such as Susan Sontag, did not like being written about in his previous works, and he writes about that also. Edmund White has been in the company of many well-known people, but what Inside a Pearl left me with was a deeper knowing of Edmund White, the writer, the gay icon, the human being. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
There's nothing so international as a powerful idea. I'm Edmund White. It is the overwhelming international flavor of the lesbian and gay rights movement that has proved so powerful over the past couple of decades. And one radio program has been there to record, to inform, and to entertain. So please keep listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine on this station.
Love letters straight from your heart. keep us so near while apart.
A kind of intimacy we express with each other seemed to me too good not to share. And since they would probably be published sometime or other after I'm dead, why not enjoy it while I'm alive?
Last time on This Way Out, we learned how the legendary glitterati Christopher Isherwood and the much younger portrait artist Don Bacardi began their more than 30-year relationship in 1953. A collection of love letters called The Animals captures their lives together. Bacardi continues his intimate revelations in the conclusion of his conversation with Charlie Bauer, Ph.D.
We always slept in the same bed. We were often wrapped around each other, sleeping. And that physical intimacy, I think, fed our relationship and kept it on a very intimate basis throughout. He died in the bed that we slept in, and I was with him the whole time.
It's just a perfect antidote to any questioning about love affairs and relationships, irrespective of gender. And the fact that you and Chris were able to keep that going to that point and to take someone to their passing. Until recently, until it was legal, a lot of people didn't have a choice in that.
Well, you see, Chris and I adopted each other to avoid any difficulties should one of us get sick. And indeed, it was a very practical decision, because when Chris was hospitalized toward the end of his life, a few days before I could get him back here into the house, there was no question of my having access to him in his hospital room, because I officially was his son.
There was a lot of times when families would take over the death of loved ones.
Yes, and disapproving family. Years that Chris and I were together, I think 33 years in all, amazing changes occurred. It was still a very primitive situation in the early 50s. If Chris and I had been told how things would change in just those 30, 40 years, we would have been amazed.
And in a way, it completely revalidates through this book your intense love for each other throughout that period.
And yes, you know, it gave it more significance, more intensity, I think, because it was still frowned on, and it was our wonderful secret that we could be two men living together intimately in our house, despite of all the disapproval that lurked right outside the front door.
What was kind of interesting, I think, particularly within your circle, is when David Hockney began to do these visual representations of queer culture.
David and Chris came from the same part of England, and Chris was the first person David Cole, when he came to Santa Monica for the first time in 64. He just found him in the phone book and called him up right away, the first, second day he was here.
I think this is a really important book. Like I said, it's the subtext of everything we think we already know. But the other side of that, which is the real and sometimes brutal honesty, are the love letters, which I think are the ones, this is what's going to endure.
Well, you have both voices. And also, I think there are a lot of laughs in the book.
You can't get away from the fact that these are all the people you know and come into contact with all the time, who maybe at that time weren't as important, as iconical as they became.
It's real gossip and first-hand hot gossip.
I couldn't put it down for those very reasons. I was leapfrogging from one to the next to the next. As I say, I mean, they were all your Christopher and his kind, and Don and his kind.
You see, in the early days, it was remarkable that Chris was that rare queer who didn't hide me away. And it was certainly embarrassing for him to have not only such a young lover, but a very young-looking lover. But he was damned if he was going to hide me away in a closet. So he insisted. He took me every... He was very close friends with Igor and Vera Stravinsky, and that was one of the first houses he took me to. And they were so sweet and adorable to me. They didn't show any kind of disapproval, nor did the Huxleys. But others did. Others were thought that Chris would actually be seen in public. He'd take me to parties with movie stars. Is he just shameless?
It's stunning.
And I was just all eyes. I was just having a great time.
Was there ever a point that you felt so uncomfortable that it was too much for you to bear in those sort of social situations?
Oh, no, I could bear anything. I was very, very tough. Well, I had this man supporting me morally, financially, and encouraging me every step of the way.
And that's part of our queer code. I mean, that's kind of what we've built up, thanks to you. Those codes have been passed on and on and on and on and on.
I hope so, yes. Yes, and I think in some sense or other, Chris felt that responsibility that we would have a public image as a gay couple and not have to tremble in the shadows because we weren't ashamed of ourselves.
Maybe it's because Chris also left Mother England, which was, as we know, is a lot more suppressed than what it would be in a place like Santa Monica.
Oh, yes, but he was a rebel from the earliest times, and that's why he had to get out of England, and he took his rebellious nature with him to this country. And it just really wasn't done in those early days.
But that rebellious nature paved the way for a lot that we really have to be thankful for today.
Because Chris wasn't ashamed of himself. He simply wouldn't cower. He knew people were wrong to disapprove of us, and he was determined that we'd set a good example.
And what he was protecting is your love, effectively.
Yes, well, what better protection can one have?
The Animals, Love Letters Between Christopher Isherwood and Don Bacardi, is edited by Catherine Bucknell and published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Bacardi was interviewed by Charlie Bauer, Ph.D.
Love letters straight from your heart.
Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones, Michelle Marie Gilkison, Janet Mason, and Charlie Bauer, Ph.D., contributed program material with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Nat King Cole performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, and our generous listeners for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WERU Bangor and Blue Hill Falls, Maine, KKRP Collington, Oklahoma, 5UV Adelaide, South Australia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.